When I go into the booth, I'm just trying to be an actor in the moment. Because once we get outside the moment as an actor, we're dead. And you've got to be so fully present. To me, that's one of the great things about being an actor. It is literally a mindfulness practice itself.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindful Voice Actor Podcast, the show that promotes mindfulness and explores topics of mental health in the world of voiceover. And today, we have a very special guest. He's a voice actor, creator of the VO Freedom Master Plan and VO Pro. Please welcome Paul Schmidt. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Percy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So, Paul, tell us about yourself. How'd you get into voiceover? Who are you?
Sometimes I struggle with that last question. So I've been a voice actor. I started actually about 23. So I started about 25 years ago in 98. I was on the air at a radio station in Wilmington, Delaware, and doing what we call production as part of my job, which means, you know, after you get off the air, they hand you 4 or 5 or 6 commercial scripts and send you into the production studio, and you go and you knock those out for the local clients. And very quickly, I realized that, you know, what we were doing on the local radio level was different and not as good as the stuff that we were getting in from the agencies and from national. And that's when I discovered this concept called voice acting. And I thought, well, this is great because I spent a long time as a kid on the stage. So I had, you know, identified as an actor for a very long time and then took a detour into radio. And that's when I ended up doing professionally. So I started then and just loved it for a long time. I actually, when I first got into it, I was still in Wilmington and I really tried to make a run. Like I really tried, like, this is what I want to do for a living, right? And to say I failed is an understatement. In those days, and this was 1998, 99, 2000, you either were in New York or LA. You had access to coaching and representation. You were a union, or you didn't have any of those things and you didn't work, right? Even in a big market like Philadelphia, Wilmington is 20 minutes south of Philly. Even there, voiceover and voice acting was, it was very apparent very soon that it was an afterthought. It was the redheaded stepchild of, you know, of performing arts. So I didn't have any of those things. I didn't work. I did a few things here and there, but it was certainly nothing that would ever lead me to believe that I could go full time and quit my job in those days. And so it stayed on the back burner for me for the better part of 20 years. And I kept, you know, accumulating clients. Our production clients would say, hey, you did our radio spot. Would you do our cable spot for us on the side? And I'd go, sure. You know, and they'd throw me a few extra bucks and everybody was happy. And to be honest, I'd do the same punchy radio read for the cable spot that I did for the radio spot. And I didn't know the difference and they didn't know the difference and everybody was happy. But as I started studying this voice acting phenomenon, okay, there's a way the pros do this, which is different and better than what I'm doing. So I actually bought a book. Remember books? Remember books with paper? I bought a book by a guy named Sandy Thomas. And Sandy wrote a book called So You Think You Want to Be a Voiceover Star. And I read that book, devoured it, took notes. I just ate that book for lunch. And I actually reached out to Sandy by U.S. mail.
And
wrote him a couple letters and he wrote back and we had a little bit of a pen pal relationship and he was very, very helpful to me in those days. And I'm sure I could walk right up to him right now and he wouldn't know who the hell I was. but he was very helpful to me and very inspirational to me. Long story short, I keep side clients for 20 years and I start to notice that my friends in the business who had gotten out of radio, some of them are doing voiceover. And it turns out some of them are full-time and they're not in New York. They're not in LA. They're not union. What's going on here? So I realized then that the world had changed. And what I mean by that is digital video had happened. YouTube had happened. Every company became a media company. And so there was so much more work out there for non-union actors than there ever had been. Plus, technology had shrunk. You know, when I put my second studio together, this version, my first studio, I had an 8-channel Mackie board and I had a rack full of equipment with a digital audio tape machine and a CD burner.
Sounds like dinosaur equipment.
Yeah, and analog signal processors. And now I've got, well, today I've got an Apollo Twin, 2 speakers and a computer. And that's all you, and a microphone.
That'll do it.
That'll do it. So everything had shrunk. It was cheaper and easier to build a home studio. The equipment is better now than it was then. And I realized that the barrier to entry had dropped significantly in those 20 years. And so when all that occurred to me, I remember having this moment standing in the living room behind my love seat. And I went, wait a minute, hold on. Marketing and sales, part-time voiceover. I've been a web developer and built websites. I've got like 3-4 core skills through no grand design, by the way. Like my career just kind of did this and it wasn't any grand design. But I realized I had a few core skills that might lead me to make a really good freelance voice actor. And when that thought occurred to me, the gloves came off. And I decided, this is what I want to do. Whatever it takes, I'm going to give it my best shot. And I spent 6 months building a plan. And I still had a day job. And once I started enacting the plan, I was able to go full-time in 9 months. I do not recommend that. For most people, it's not even remotely possible. It was remotely possible for me, but I'll tell you, I probably should have stuck it out about 1.5 years. And I think for most people, it takes 3 to 5 years.
Oh yeah, that's pretty much the track that I'm on. But you had a lot of skills leading up to that. It's not like you just decided, I want to be a voice actor and went on a pay-to-play and then just made that goal. That would have been remarkable.
Exactly. I already had some coaching in my pocket, right? I already had some training in my pocket. I got better training. Part of that 6 months, I was building out my website and my messaging. I was in the process of re-recording demos to raise my demo game. So there was a lot that went into it before I even started marketing, right? And then, when I did, it didn't take long.
That's amazing. So we've talked about this previously. You are someone who's very knowledgeable about mental health. And we spoke about how throughout your career and your life, you dealt with some anxiety. And even despite your skills and talent and the fact that you were able to become full-time in 9 months. Tell me about that and how it's affected you in your life and your career.
Sure. So I wouldn't say I'm knowledgeable about mental health, but I'm knowledgeable about my experience with mental health.
That's what I meant. Yeah. You know yourself.
I do think that we have different mental health diseases, issues, right? Diagnoses. One person might have depression, another person might suffer from anxiety and so on. But even within that, my anxiety isn't necessarily the same experience somebody else might have with anxiety. When I was younger, I had depression in my 20s and 30s. It was moderate. It no doubt was ruinous to my life, but I was never suicidal. I never once had suicidal thoughts. I was a hot mess because of it, but I never thought of suicide. I'm going to tell you that I generally grew out of depression. I haven't had a depressive thought in probably 15 years.
Lucky.
But once I got out of that,
say the same.
my old joke was, you know, once I got divorced, my depression cleared up. And then, which is true, but they're not cause and effect,
I'm pretty sure.
So once that cleared up, I always knew. Like even going back to my teen years, I've always had a high level of what I experienced as irritability, right? A little bit of a short fuse, always short-tempered. I describe it as it's like somebody behind you poking you with a fork, right? Not enough to hurt, but enough to just cause long-term fatigue so that when the least little thing goes wrong in your life, in your day, in your hour, you just lose your shit. And that's not a fine way to live, let me tell you. But I always experienced it as irritability. And I just accepted that this was a facet of my personality that was just the way I was, right? I had accepted that. And about 2 years ago, I was dating a woman and explaining this to her. And she said, "That's anxiety." And I said, no, it's not. It's irritability. And she said, "I'm telling you, I experienced it the same way. And what you have is anxiety." And I, of course, was very stubborn, still am. And I said, "No." And she said, "Will you let me make an appointment for you with a psychiatrist?" And I said, "If you feel that strongly about it, then yes." And she literally took the ball, took action, dug into my health insurance, found who to call, made the appointment for me. And 10 minutes into the appointment, the psychiatrist looked at me and said, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure she's right. That's anxiety." And he put me on a medication at a trial dose, which, by the way, I'm still on today, the same dose. And Percy, within 7 to 10 days, it changed my life. So I don't say that lightly, because I was very skeptical going in. When I had depression 20 years ago, I went through just about every antidepressive medication there was, some with really bad side effects for me. So I was not optimistic that this was going to work. And I'm telling you, my son, who was 13, 14 at the time, he noticed it in the first week. And I describe it to you this way. Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor, had a quote that I am now going to butcher, but the gist of it was, there's a gap between stimulus and response, and we get to choose what we do in that gap. My experience of anxiety was, there was no gap. There was stimulus and response. It was reflexive, and there was no gap at all. And now I have a gap, right? Now I'm able to absorb something and choose a response, which I couldn't do before.
That's incredible. I know lots of people who struggle with that as well. And unfortunately, we live in a world, especially as voice actors, where there are so many potential stressors that can trigger those sort of responses. And it's important that we're able to pause and think about it without it feeling like that fork in your back's being like, you know, do something. You've got to react right now.
Absolutely. To have just that half a second, if it's even that, to be able to take a beat, process something that's happened. You know, through the lens of the medication now, I can look and go, 95, 98% of that stuff is just small, everyday little stuff. It's not the stuff that was happening to me that was bad. It was the fact that everything was setting me off. Everything is a threat. And so it's almost like your fight or flight is constantly engaged.
Absolutely. Yeah. And were you able to figure this out on your own, or did you seek therapy in order to realize what you needed to do in those moments between cause and effect, or what is it?
Yeah. No, I like just having literally just taking the medication. And I, to this day, right now, I don't do any therapy because I'm I'm happier and more fulfilled than I've ever been. And I'm able to conduct my life in a way that makes me proud, because to be that guy that is constantly irritated at everything and everyone, I hated that aspect of my personality. I mean, I was ashamed of it. I hated it. I wanted to change it. I felt powerless against it. And to be the person that I always knew I could be is fulfilling in a way that I can't describe.
That's incredible. Could you name any specific examples of ways in which the medication changed a specific sort of response to a situation that otherwise you would have just been like, you know, crazy?
Probably the easiest is, you know, traffic. Now, I will still say, to this day, I still have a mouth like a sailor when I'm behind the wheel, right?
Oh no!
but that's almost a parody of my former self, right? I do it more or less to entertain myself. Now, before, it bordered on road rage, and I did have one instance of road rage, which I'm very ashamed to say my son witnessed, and he was about 10 at the time. I want to say 10 or 11, and frankly, I could have been killed. Because I couldn't hold my temper. And so now the water rolls off the duck's back much easier. It's not to say that I never get irritated, but I'm well within the realm of reasonability now, which is all I ever wanted.
That's great. I feel like that's all anyone could ever want.
Yeah.
So I wanted to talk to you about mindfulness and ways that you apply it to those moments of stress or potential difficulties while in the booth. Is there something that you do to help calm yourself or ground yourself? Anything like that?
So to me, stress is either usually one of two things. We're either lamenting the past or we're worrying about the future. Rarely are we ever stressed about this particular moment in time. And so when I go into the booth, I really do my honest best to focus on the copy, the layers in the copy, the relationship, the pretext, all the stuff that I'm learning from my amazing commercial coach, Tina Marasco. I'm just trying to be an actor in the moment, right? Because once we get outside the moment as an actor, we're dead. We start thinking about how we sound, we're dead. We start thinking about what we're having for lunch, we're dead. It's all got to be in the moment, and you've got to be so fully present. And to me, that's one of the great things about being an actor, is it is literally a mindfulness practice itself.
Absolutely. And you talk about being able to set down whatever emotional baggage you have going on outside the booth. You just set it down, right? And then you can pick it up later. You don't try to like suppress it in any way, right?
Well, it's one of those things. It's very easy to say. Sometimes it's not so easy to do. It's certainly very much easier for me to do when I'm taking my medicine, right? Because that's you know, I have a greater capacity to do that. And look, life still happens. If you're in a position where you've got a huge life stressor, maybe someone dear is sick. Maybe you've lost someone. Maybe there are great financial pressures. God knows what people go through. And it's very glib of me to say, oh, just sit it down outside the booth. We all try to do that. But I fully understand that everybody's capacity and capacity in a given season of life varies greatly. And you just do the best you can.
That's actually something that I tell people when they feel like they're not being good enough or they're not trying their best, this and that. I say, you know, sometimes good enough is good enough. You do your best. You don't beat yourself up about it. I have friends that say, chuck it in the F it, or, you know, this is my show. They say, chuck it in the fuck it bucket. If there's ever something that you're worried about, or you talk down to yourself, I shouldn't have done that, the should have, could have, would have, just chuck it in the fuck it bucket. It's gone.
I was raised Catholic. And in that culture, there is a huge amount of self-flagellation and guilt that is taught. And I think it's entirely useless. I think perfectionism grows out of that. And I think perfectionism is a mental health pandemic.
Absolutely. Especially in our industry. But
absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
My gosh.
Beating yourself up serves no one, period. Right? People say, well, you know, and we've got this great catchphrase in our culture. I'm my own worst critic. Why? Dear God, why? You should be your own best friend. And I don't say that to be all, you know, woo-woo, but I'm reading listening to a great audiobook now by a guy named Greg Hardin. And Greg has been for 25, 30 years, the sports psychologist at the University of Michigan. So he's worked with people like Tom Brady and even Michael Phelps, even though he didn't attend Michigan. He was a student coach there for a while. He's worked with the gymnastics team and the football players and the basketball players and literally these people that are highly driven. And he said, you know, you've got to become your own best friend. So there's a skill that I'm now trying to practice is refining my inner dialogue so that I'm speaking to myself as though I would speak to my best friend. Why not? Like, why should I knock myself down? What good can that possibly give rise to, right?
Right. And we feel like that voice in our head really isn't necessarily us. It's sort of what we think society's expectations are of how we should be performing, sounding. there are some times where I'll do like 20 takes in a row. And I know by that maybe sixth, seventh, eighth take, I'm like, I should be not in here right now. I should be going outside and putting my mind elsewhere because I'm only going to psych myself out more. And I'm in effect making myself feel as though if I keep doing it, I'll get better at it. And because I'm not good enough the first, second, third time or whatever. And I'll show them to people, be like, which one do you think's the best? And they're like, we don't really hear much of a difference between them, but I'll hear something. I'll delete the whole track. If I'm doing an audition and I don't like maybe a certain part of it, I think that whole thing needs to be thrown out. And that's awful. That's me treating myself as though I don't have the ability to do what I'm paid to do right in a way that's so minuscule. No one else can even notice it except for me. And I feel like that's so toxic.
It is toxic. Brené Brown has a great quote, which I will also butcher. And she says that essentially that perfectionism is a defensive move. It is a way of avoiding judgment. And I absolutely agree with that. It is rather than put the work out there for judgment, I'm never going to put it out there and say it's imperfect and therefore it shouldn't be put out there, which is complete bullshit. The other thing that you touched on is, you know, you said that that voice is often someone else's. Usually, it's a parent or some other authority figure that drilled that into you, that you weren't good enough or in some way was judgmental, or you interpreted that as I'm not good enough and they're judging me. You've got to be your own best friend. You absolutely, and your own best supporter. In your situation, I think, maybe there's some perfectionism going on. There's definitely overthinking going on.
Constantly.
Yeah. And that's a kind of another pandemic that we face too, especially as actors, right? If you don't, I mean, anymore, if I don't feel it by about the fifth or sixth take, well, then what I have goes out the door and I'm going to try again tomorrow, right? Because I'll make myself crazy and I'm not here to be crazy.
You're not here to be crazy. You're here to be a voice actor.
I'm here to get a little bit better every day. And some days I get a little bit worse. But some days I'll take a step back or two. But over time, I'm going to get a little bit better.
Oh, yeah. Any sort of progress that you try to make, whether you're improving a skill, whether it's grief, it's never linear. And nope. If you expect it to be linear, then you're just going to be hard on yourself at the times that you fall back. You have to notice those moments, be like, okay, I fell back. That's all it was. Am I getting back up? Yes.
Yeah.
I am the type of person, well, sometimes I'll be down there in that place you fall down and not so much anymore, but I'd have what my mom called a pity party. She's like, how many people go to a pity party? Just one. But I'd be down there. Why am I like this? Growing up, having ADHD, my parents were not hard on me, but I was hard on myself because I didn't understand why I wasn't able to accomplish the same things as my peers in terms of getting work in on time, being able to organize, etc. And that definitely affects me in my voiceover career. And I think as voice actors, it's important, not just in the context of mental illness, but to remember that we are human. And as Yep. professionals we want to be, and as much as we want to think of ourselves as voice actors, we're in it, this is our livelihood. At the same time, that takes away our humanity and us giving ourselves that leniency to mess up. We need to remember ourselves that that's okay. We're people.
Yep. I've started a thing, and it usually happens. First thing I do when I get up in the morning after I walk the dog is I make coffee. And so I'm in the kitchen is generally the first room I spend some real time in the morning. And usually before I get out of the kitchen, Percy, I've done something dumb, right? Doesn't mean I am dumb, but I've taken to noticing it and saying, that's number one. In other words, that's number one. I'm going to make a bunch of mistakes today, and that's fine. It's fine. That's number one. There's going to be more.
Can you tell me the number one? I'm just curious.
Well, usually, like, I don't know. It could be anything. Like, I'm staring into a cabinet which doesn't contain plates looking for a plate, right? It could be anything dumb like that. I look in the refrigerator and I realize for the third day in a row, I'm out of milk. Like I meant to go to the store anything, right? I made a mistake. That's all it was. Or I didn't, you know, I didn't choose to pay enough attention to this thing.
Right. And that can be frustrating, but...
if you let it.
Yeah, exactly.
If you let it. Like, I've really trying to consciously lately just left that stuff off and just go, that's number one. There's going to be a lot more today.
Right. But you're not counting it as a means to like tally up how much of a fuck up you are.
Exactly. Because I would say out loud, ah, you dumb asshole. Right. Like that was my inner and sometimes outer dialogue. And like, I'm like, what does that serve? That doesn't serve anything. Right? There's nobody around to laugh at that, first of all. So I was very self-deprecating for a very long time. And I started realizing that our dialogue drives our thoughts and vice versa. And that all drives our behaviors. And that's not the guy I want to be.
No. And it's not the example you want to set for your son, for example. No. I forget how many you have just your son.
Yeah, I've got, they're not going to see this on the audio podcast, but this guy, he's about to turn 17 this month.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must be, I mean, for any parent, 17, it's like, you're almost there, almost no longer a kid.
Yeah, I'm that parent that I will be a bawling puddle of goo the day he goes off to college. I fell head over heels in love with my son. When he was about 6 days old, and it's been that way ever since. And the dog just sneezed.
I heard that. Gesundheit.
You okay, Gus? All right, buddy? And while it is the goal to raise a happy, well-adjusted young man, for my own selfishness, it will break my heart when he launches his life, even though that's the goal, right? And I will be thrilled for him. And heartbroken for me because it's been the greatest thing I've ever done, you know?
That's amazing. Yeah, to think of all your accomplishments in life and how hard you've worked.
Second isn't even close.
This is actually a topic I wanted to touch on because the way you're able to show your sensitivity toward the issue and not feel like you have to hold it in because you're a man and you're supposed to be tough. You're someone who is able to talk about your mental health. Whereas a lot of men in the society, there's pressure. You can't talk about these things openly. You have to stay strong. It's not masculine or manly to talk about your feelings or your struggles or anything. Has that affected your ability to at least admit to yourself that you had a problem with anxiety or any other aspect of your life?
I think it did when I was young. That was also when I was young, was 30, 40 years ago, right? I'm 56 now. And I think part of it was the time, right? We weren't culturally as aware of mental health and mental health issues as we are today. And two, I hadn't had as much experience with it. My dad struggled with depression. And while he did seek treatment, he never really talked about it with me. Now, that could have been just because I was his child. I don't get the sense that he talked about it to a lot of folks. And we never really talked about it after I became an adult, for whatever reason. So I don't think that I ever had, I never felt like my depression, and certainly my anxiety later in life, I never felt like I had to sort of keep that under wraps, right? Like I've always was fairly open with people about it. And I do think that what you're talking about is what I call toxic masculinity, right?
Like call it that? We all call it that.
Yeah.
It's what it is.
Well, people that have it don't call it that, right? They just call
point.
It the way of life. And I think a lot of that is passed down from generation to generation. I know, you know, families that's just the culture of the family. They don't talk about stuff. And I think that's incredibly dangerous. And it's also, if it's in your familial culture, it's incredibly hard to change over the course of generations, right? And so there's a challenge there. I, for whatever reason, like in my family, we didn't talk about mental illness. But for whatever reason, I never really felt like it was a taboo thing. I talk about it because I feel like if I relate my experience, then maybe somebody else can learn something, see something in themselves, get some help that they need. I'm big on action. And, you know, thoughts and prayers are nice, but thoughts and prayers at the end of the day, they don't do shit, right?
No.
You've got to take action. You've got to be your own best advocate. You have got to put in the work if that's what's required. If there were therapy work that I thought would help me, I'd be in the therapist's office tomorrow. Right now, I'm in a season of my life where everything's pretty okay. That could change. And it can change in a heartbeat.
Yeah. And you'd be open and willing to taking whatever steps it would take to remedy that.
Yeah. I've been in therapy before and I see the value in it and it's helped me immensely at times in my life. I just happen to be in a season right now where it's not really necessary.
Right. And I, as someone who has been in therapy pretty much with no breaks for about 20 years, I myself didn't actually, or maybe even still doesn't actually believe that I could ever be without therapy. But my therapist actually said the other day, I had asked her and she's like, no, I could see it. I'm like, what are you talking about? I have all these issues and how am I ever going to get by without being able to discuss them openly with you? And she says that she could see a point in my life where despite my struggles with ADHD, bipolar disorder, and the like, that I could be able to achieve a level of success, not career-wise, but in other aspects of my life that would lead to me being able to be not just my own best advocate, but even maybe deal with issues that I otherwise felt like I couldn't. Because I think a lot of it too is I am obviously a huge proponent of therapy. I love it. I love my therapist. But I definitely think that it's important to be able to take what you learn in therapy and apply it to your life. I don't just do talk therapy. It's part of it, but I also learn aspects of cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness as a part of my therapy sessions. These are things that I take outside of the session and am able to utilize to make my life better.
I agree. And I think there are multiple skills that can be developed, right? The real tangible example is that example I gave you from Greg Hardin's book, right? Being your own best friend, taking that and trying to work on your own inner dialogue daily. That's a life skill that you could get from therapy. You could get it from a book. You could get it from talking to a friend. You could get it by, you know, somebody in your life leads by example in that way. So yeah, I agree. But skill development has been key for me over the years. And learning how to manage that stuff myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Have you ever had a specific instance maybe with a client or some aspect of your specific work or with the programs that you run where you were particularly stressed out or felt like you didn't have control over a situation that maybe you were able to remedy later or not?
Well, I remember there's one instance that kind of comes to mind. In fact, my biggest client right now is, ironically, a company that produces mental skills training through visualization and meditation. And the first app, they're called APEAK, and the first app that they did was called APEAK Tennis, and it was geared towards competitive tennis players. And so it was mental conditioning for competitive tennis players. They've since also done and just launched a new app called Superior Mind, which is for anybody, right? You don't have to be necessarily even an athlete. You can be anybody that wants to get mindfulness training, visualization training, and to be able to just optimize their performance, whether it's in a relationship, whether it's at work, whether it's on the, you know, basketball court, you know, whatever it might be. So it's a little bit more mainstream. And when we first started working together, the client, great guy named Brian Park, he insisted that we do some live sessions together so that he could coach me in the way that he wanted the content delivered. And we agreed we'd do a live session and get all that done. And he was more than gracious, paid the rate, the whole nine yards. We ended up doing 6 live sessions. And by about the third one, I'm beating my head against the wall, right? But again, I had that gap between stimulus and response, and I had the ability to be patient and really understand that if I can serve this guy and give him exactly what he wants, he's going to be immensely happier with the outcome than if I just try and put my head down and, you know, sort of do what I do with this material. I had to learn his style, and it's served us both ever since. So I would say that's an example of a more general thing where my patience is much greater on the medication than it is off. And that is not only applies to voiceover and my businesses, but it applies to my life as well. I'm more patient with my son. I'm more patient with Gus back there, wherever he is. Where'd you go, Gus? he's busy chasing a flea or something. But yeah, I mean, I just have a greater capacity for patience than normal.
And that's great because I feel like in society, our attention span and our ability to be patient or tolerate waiting in any way is very low.
I used to tell people I yell at the microwave. I mean, come on, hurry up, let's go. Right? And it was true. And now I have that gap that allows me more patience. So.
Yeah. That impatience also, whether you're yelling at the microwave or not, takes you out of the moment. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, it takes away your ability to be present and appreciate where you are, what you're doing. There's a comedian who talked about people who complain that their TV isn't working on the airplane when they're on a flight. And he's like, do you realize what's going on right now? The engineering that went into us just being up here in the sky and the appreciation.
Louis C.K.
Yeah.
You're sitting in a chair
in the sky.
In the sky.
It was Louis C.K., but I know he got in that scandal. I didn't want to say it. But yes, Louis C.K. says, he says, you're sitting in a chair in the sky. You're like a Greek myth right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the programs that you run. You guys have meetings. You and your students will meet every so often to talk about your goals and whatever issues you might be dealing with. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So there's a slew of ways that sort of happens within our community. So there is the community. This is really, and this is one of the things I'm trying to work out in my business because it's very confusing to people. There is the VO Pro community, which is one thing. And a large section of that community are students that are also in our VO Freedom Master Plan, which is our marketing program. Okay. But the community, to simplify things, we'll just talk about VO Pro as a whole. The first thing is we have three rituals every week that we practice. Number one is Monday goals, where we lay out the behaviors that we hope through the execution of those behaviors that are going to move the needle in our businesses. So what are the things that we're working on? What are the actions that we have to take this week to move the needle, even if it's just that far? So that's Monday goals. And what that does is it holds us accountable to the group and it holds the group accountable to us because we share those goals publicly. And once you put them down on paper, even if it's for yourself, that's a big step. When you put it out there in the world, it's a bigger step. And we support each other, we cheer each other on, and we don't judge, you know, because look, you can put your goals down Monday 9 a.m. and by 9:20, the week can get sideways on you. Which is why we have our second ritual, which is called midweek challenges. The best laid plans, said Steinberg. The best laid plans of mice and men. And so the week can get sideways really quick. Stuff comes up we didn't anticipate. There's always adversity and curveballs that life throws at us. We have a space in the community where we can share those challenges and ask for help if we need to. And then Friday is the third ritual, which is called Friday Wins, where we list. And to me, this is the most important of all of them because you talked about all the rejection that we face in this business. I love Emma O'Neill's way of framing rejection. She calls it lack of selection. And I love that because that's really what it is, right? You do 100 auditions. You may have done 100 really good auditions, but you were only right for maybe two of those roles. Or maybe there was somebody more right for the other 98 roles. Doesn't mean you did bad work. It means you weren't selected for that role. That's all it means. Your job is to, and I just read this quote this week from Bryan Cranston. He said, your job is not to get a job when you're auditioning. Your job is to present what you do and let them decide whether you're the right person for this particular role. And so with Friday Wins, Our job is to then celebrate the progress, even if it's that much. We have a catchphrase for Friday Wins. We say, big or small, post them all. Because even if it's, you know, this week I reached out to one more person than I did last week, or I got on a roster this week. I didn't get a job, but I got on a roster. Somebody said, hey, they like your stuff. They'll keep you in mind, right? Whatever it is. Sometimes those wins map back to Monday's goals, and it makes a nice, neat package. Sometimes they might map back to something we had as a goal 6 months ago. It doesn't matter. We celebrate the progress, and we are accountable to ourselves for our progress, because if we don't practice that, it's real easy to go, man, I did 40 auditions this week, and I didn't even get a sniff. Some weeks are going to be like that. They just are. Doesn't mean you sucked that week. Doesn't mean you were great this week and everybody had their head up their fifth point of contact. It just means did 40 auditions. That's a euphemism.
Okay. I
just learned that from somebody this week.
Okay, I'll have to ask about that later. What
yeah.
are you saying?
It just means that you did 40 auditions. You didn't get hired yet, right?
I'm someone who also is a huge proponent of focusing on those wins, as small as they are.
Heck,
even in your life, if you're having a really bad day, if you suffer from depression, it's really hard to even get out of the house. Making yourself go out, getting groceries, that's awesome. It's easy to be like, oh, but I should have been able to do this, or I should have. I have an old coach who used to tell me, don't should yourself. Stop shooting yourself, because it doesn't serve you. It's going to negate whatever progress you were able to make despite how you were feeling, because it makes you feel like you weren't doing your best, but in reality you were. And that's something to celebrate.
Yeah.
Paul, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Is there anything you want to plug or talk about yourself, what you're doing, what people can do to reach out to you?
People can find all the information about me they want at paulschmidtpro.com, S-C-H-M-I-D-T.
All right, awesome. And you can follow us at themindfulvoiceactor.com. All our socials are The Mindful Voice Actor, Instagram, Facebook, all that. And you can subscribe to our mailing list at subscribe.themindfulvoiceactor.com. We are available to listen to on all major platforms. Paul, again, thank you for this conversation. It was amazing and enlightening, and I'm so happy you were able to be here and be our guest today.
Well, thank you. It was you who found me and reached out, and I'm so grateful you did, Percy. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem, of course. Now, I'll end with this. Ours is the one ever-present voice in our lives. Therefore, it is crucial that our self-talk instill confidence within us and is supportive, not submerging, and that our attitudes toward ourselves help keep our spirits afloat through acceptance and trust. We are our own most important and influential buoy. And with that, I'll see you next time.